Welcome to the Software Cross podcast. I'm your host, João, and today with me I have Patrick. Patrick is a seasoned technology leader with almost 20 years of experience. His personal passion is accelerating the growth and success of tech organizations and technical leaders. He has many years of hands-on experience leading, managing, and improving complex organizations and software systems as CTO and Chief Scientist of N26, and as technical principal consultant at ThoughtWorks. He's a frequent keynote, conference speaker, author of three books including the Retrospective Zen book, Talking with Tech Leads, and Building Evolutionary Architectures, and runs the free popular newsletters for leaders in tech, Level Up. You can check out levelup.petcua.com. And Tech Lead Academy, offering online training for technical leaders. You can find him online on Twitter as @petcua. Or running his very popular shortcut to tech leadership workshop. Hi, Pat. Long introduction. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Thanks for your time. And going to the pattern today, not an heuristic, a pattern, we start with it. It is the side closest to the action. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, so I think it's a great pattern or heuristic. It reminds me a lot about sort of the lean manufacturing or sort of going to the Gemba. So I've done a lot of leadership management, and one of the interesting things that came from sort of lean manufacturing was the people who are best suited to solve a problem are the people who are closest to that. They have the most information, most up to date. So that heuristic really rings with me because that's true in software where there are so many moving parts that if you're a leader very far away, it's difficult to know what sometimes the right decision is because you're missing a lot of information and there's a cost to collecting that information. So that heuristic really rings very true to me about trying to involve the people who are closest to the problem. And I think about, you know, like an incident, for example, that's happening in production, is that it's not very helpful for somebody who is not involved in that to suddenly decide what is the right way to solve that incident. And the people who are closest to it will know some of the signs around that. So I think it actually rings very true.
Nice. And as technical leader and in your career, you experiment several models. How do you help a company grow and at the same time don't get involved on these operational or day-to-day work? What is your best advice for technical leaders?
It's a challenge because at the end of the day, a lot of this is a judgment call. I like to give people some advice about how to deal with this balance quite well. So one of them is to, you know, if you're going to get involved in the operational side, there has to be a good reason for that. So if you're reacting to something, you know, maybe you're the person who has the most knowledge for that. And therefore it makes sense for you to be involved because you're sort of the closest to the problem. But as a leader, you're not always going to have that free time. Your attention split to lots of other ways. So in that sort of case, you probably want to be sort of transmitting that knowledge to other people. So it's the sort of, you can deal with it and be sort of involved, but try to make sure that you don't be involved the next time and you try to work out why you had to be involved as part of that. You know, I think the other thing, depending on the sort of team and the organization that you're dealing with, it makes sense to be sometimes involved operationally because you may be the most expert person on that, right? So, you know, we have a lot of people new to the industry and you may have the quickest way to resolve or know how to deal with a problem. But you have to always work out a way of sort of improving the system so it doesn't become dependent on you. And hopefully if you get into that habit of sort of teaching people or sharing knowledge, you get to a point where you can step back and allow other people to sort of deal with the more sort of operational or reactionary type of topics.
Interesting. So if I can summarize well, it's the balance between a company growing and jumping into the operational and get back. So I have, how can myself as a leader, if I go down that path, keep doing these retrospective to myself to know if I'm stepping too much or if I leave people swimming in the pool?
Yep. I often talk about the reactionary hamster wheel, right, is you can get into this sort of furious wheel of you react to something because you don't have time, and then you sort of have to deal with it, right? That's a natural thing. You want to deal with emergencies, make them go away. But also if you're sort of constantly reacting, you kind of end up with no time. And so part of the skill of a leader is sort of reacting, but also sort of trying to create space to prevent you from reacting again in the future. And so that's how you kind of get off that hamster wheel, which is effectively time management, right? So this is really thinking about, okay, there may be emergencies happening all the time right now, but what you have to do is sort of think about, okay, what do you do to constantly improve the system to step away? So I kind of think more about trajectory rather than like your current state, because you as a leader need to be improving the system. Like that's one of the purposes of a leader. And unfortunately, nobody tells you how. So you're kind of expected to work out what's the best way of improving the system, and also create space for other people to also contribute to improving the system. But it's hard to do that if you're in that reactionary hamster wheel of reacting and have no time to sort of think about the system and improve that. So the biggest tip is really like really making time in advance to make sure you have that reflection time. And to catch yourself if you are in this reactionary hamster wheel, just constantly reacting.
Cool, cool. I am taking that tip into account. I hope that audience will also share their tips and tricks. And you are known to be an advocate for technical leadership. I also talk with different people in the industry that they have their own view of technical leadership. What is your view on this topic?
So my perspective of technical leadership is anyone can sort of do technical leadership. You don't need to be attached to a role to do that. So a classic example might be a senior engineer sort of seeing a problem in a team and then rallying the team around that to agree on a way to solve that problem. So you don't need to have a title to be allowed to do this. The second thing is really about that alignment of people around these technical topics. And that's a hard thing because every engineer has their opinions often in disagreement, but the art of leadership is sort of that same direction and everyone pulling in that same direction, which obviously gets more complex the more people you have. So the larger the organization, the more complex that gets and the harder that gets to sort of get everyone aligned in that same direction. I think those are the two key aspects, because I can think of examples where I've seen a lack of technical leadership and it literally is just a bunch of people, individuals working together on code and the code looks awful, right? Like everyone's worked in a system like this where you know who wrote which part of that code base. And you're kind of scared to go in there to touch it because, you know, you might get some bad reactions or whatever, but that's a lack of technical leadership in that, you know, everyone has their own style and the team is not pulling in the same direction. So two things, anyone can be a leader, right? It just takes an action of really seeing a topic where you see misalignment around a technical topic. And then the second thing is the hard bit of working with people to create that consistent direction and buy-in and make sure that you're heading in that same direction as a group.
Very nice principles, thanks. And in terms of practices, you name a very specific example, the code base that people don't want to touch. Do you see more people practicing pair programming or mob programming as a way to share this knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of pair programming and mob programming. I do think, though, it's one of the hardest practices, particularly pair programming, for a lot of engineers. I think it requires a high degree of trust and safety, and unfortunately, a lot of teams don't have that. So I've been fortunate enough to work in a lot of places where that is existing there, and that's what I see as the role of sort of management and leadership, to create that psychological safety so that people feel that they can trust each other and they can sort of take feedback without feeling sort of slighted or offended. And then you get the best out of sort of working and learning from each other. And so pair programming and mob programming, I think, are excellent practices. But I know that a lot of organizations don't use them because it requires a sort of high degree of trust and sort of collaboration, which sometimes doesn't exist in teams.
Indeed. I can see definitely these on our industry, and I'm very curious. So I have a friend that sees the role of a manager more as a facilitator today. Do you see this as well?
Yes and no. So I often describe managers as people who should focus on the system. So I think a lot of people think people need to be managed. And I defer to Admiral Grace Hopper, who once said, you manage things, not people, right? So you lead people because engineers are smart, creative, they have opinions. You don't need to manage them, but you want to manage the system in which they're working. And so facilitation is one skill that I think you need to manage in terms of the process, perhaps, of how people can surface opinions. But another thing that managers, I think, are very key for responsible for are also things like reward systems, because things like reward systems can sort of build a team or it can destroy a team. As an example, you know, if every engineer is rewarded for the code that they personally write, you know, there's less incentive for them to want to help and collaborate with their team members because they're rewarded for the feature they produce. And that's quite different if you're rewarding the team for sort of the outcome that they're having, because then there's more reason for the team to help each other out because they're working on a common goal. And so that itself is a process that management is responsible for, which is why you have to sort of think about the ecosystem in which people are working. Another example is perhaps you might have different roles in a team. And in some teams I've worked in, you know, those roles are a lot more loose. You have a lot more, you know, the team has to make sure that all of these responsibilities are taken care of. And I've worked in teams where, you know, it's very clear who does, for instance, QA. And as a result, there's an interesting separation where, you know, developers have a mindset of, oh, it's not my responsibility to test my code. It's the quality assurance person's, right? And once again, you get that silo thinking, and that itself is a management sort of responsibility that created this system. And that's what I see a lot of the role of management doing, is looking at those systems of how these create the wrong behaviors or incentives, and not necessarily managing people as such.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. So I was writing lots of notes because now more questions are popping up, but I see where you are coming. I totally agree that a manager should be responsible for the ecosystem and even putting some constraints in place that help people to excel. Yeah. And a trend that I'm observing, and you might observe a different trend, but I see some managers moving towards rewarding teams, but taking tools like OKRs to the letter. Do you see this as harmful to the behavior of a team?
OKRs are a tricky one because I think a lot of people forget about what OKRs were meant to be. And this is really about helping create alignment across the organization and to create transparency of what everyone is working on. Because there'll be times where, you know, you're dependent on another team, but they may be working on something else. And if their goals aren't clear, it can just feel political or frustrating. But if their goals are clear, then you kind of know, well, they're dedicated to something that is like, you know, a higher priority than what our team is working on, for instance. And so that's part of the challenge. Yeah, you're right, is that, you know, when people hold people sort of accountable for OKRs, they kind of forget about some of the purposes of, you know, that, for instance, you might need to rely on another team and they're working on a different goal. And so I think this is where, like everything for management, you have to kind of take a little bit of judgment in, and you have to be cautious about sort of measuring people to the letter of that. And, you know, when it's done poorly, I often describe it as the old style of what you used to call management by objectives. And this is already sort of well known in sort of a management field for being a sort of bad pattern, because you'll often get people who are so focused on a single goal, they forget about the bigger picture and they kind of like ignore anything that may actually help, or ignore an opportunity that may actually help the organization or other teams, because they're so focused on, once again, their individual goal rather than, you know, the organizational purpose or the priority. So it's a dangerous one, I agree, about trying to be too siloed. I think it's useful to have to create clarity and visibility and to create alignment. But once again, you have to be careful about, you know, managing people to particularly individual OKRs.
Yeah, I can see that our OKRs are the new management by objective. So time will tell. But I also...
When poorly implemented.
exactly. So I will like to challenge here, if you see team topologies from Matthew and Manuel as a good way to extract intent. What is my goal? What is my objective? And how are we interacting?
What I like about a lot of the team topology stuff is that it sort of creates that clarity again, right? So around teams that are around a product area, it's kind of clear. And I think that's interesting in that they sort of talk about different contexts for teams around what they're doing. So when you're thinking about something like a platform team, you know, their goal isn't necessarily product related directly, but really about sort of improving the effectiveness of other teams. So what I really like about the team topology is it talks about context, and context is really important because there's no such thing as you do this for every single instance like a team. And so it creates that vocabulary around what sort of teams that you're actually dealing with. And the other thing is kind of like it explores some of the trade-offs with, you know, dedicated teams or a more temporary structure. So I really like a lot of the things that they talk about in team topologies.
Cool. And I see that you also mentioned context and heuristics and patterns. What are your heuristics or patterns to help an organization to see the big picture?
That's a big question. Yes. I find, as a developer, you got trained to sort of be taught good code is often about don't repeat yourself. And what I think about good leadership and management is you have to repeat yourself continuously. I defer to Simon Sinek, who has an excellent book called Start With Why. And unfortunately, engineers, you know, we like to problem solve, and, you know, we take the why, we take the context, and we often come out with the solution. And then we talk about fear as the solution. And part of the art of leadership is sort of going back to your intent. What are you trying to do? Why are you trying to do it? And really trying to hammer the why and the impact. So I think that's the biggest lesson that I've learned over my time, is that you have to be able to repeat this so much at so many different levels through many different channels, be it, you know, one-to-ones or in a town hall or over email. But you really want to be communicating to people what's the, you know, current focus of the organization, why is that? To create the right context so that others can make better decisions at the sort of more micro level.
Very interesting. Thanks. Definitely will be in the description of the episode if people want to follow up on that. And you also mentioned now 101s and town halls or emails. Mm. And today, well, we are remote. Everyone is remote across the world. New opportunities, because I can work with different people on the other side of the world. But as a manager that is used to this synchronous way, what can we learn, on what the management community can learn to go on this remote way where perhaps asynchronous is default mode?
Yeah, one of my guiding principles, maybe going to heuristics, is kind of like the old Fred Brooks, no silver bullet. And the way that I kind of think about leadership and particular communication is kind of like filling a toolkit with many different things that you pull out in different contexts. And so I think this is an interesting thing where, you know, I don't think there's a right thing about, you know, synchronous is better than asynchronous. I think it's more of a question of like, where do you use these and how do you use them better? And can you use them together to strengthen things? So as an example, you know, a synchronous thing might be you're talking about a message in a town hall saying, you know, this is the priority for what our team is working on or our department's working on for this quarter. But obviously people will hear things, not everyone will be part of that town hall. And so you want to have that written down somewhere so that you can sort of refer people to that. I often talk about sort of the rule of three. So, you know, in code, we talk about three strikes, you're a factor. Same thing when I'm thinking about sort of management and leadership, is that you want to repeat your message at least three times in three different ways. So it might be, you know, your town hall, it might be an email after that, sort of recapping that. It might be then a wiki page that then sort of has that. And then you're sort of covering all of these, both synchronous and asynchronous methods. So, you know, at the end of the day, you have to experiment. And one of the best ways of testing for communication is sort of polling to see if people have understood that. So I think as a manager and a leader, you have to try many different things. If you're only trying one way, you're definitely going to miss out on a whole bunch of people because it's maybe not their preferred way of sort of engaging. So,
yeah, indeed, it's about discovering the preferences, personal preferences, and indeed, interesting tips, thanks. And you also talk about, now you mention an interesting word, experiments.
And yes.
As a developer, I can do experiments pretty quickly, right? If I have a mature development process, even in my machine, the tests will scream if my experience is wrong, or I can put in production and then I have A-B testing, and we have that. But as I progress to a manager, doing experiments can be at the expense of people, and people have feelings, and I can put things down. So what is your experience to set up these experiments within an organization and within the system, as you classify?
Yeah, it's a great question because it does involve people. One of the most essential practices, I think, particularly at a team level, is the retrospective, because it creates visibility about a common issue. And then hopefully, if you have an effective retrospective, you should come at the end of that with an experiment, an action that you use to, you know, deal or approach a problem. There's no guarantee it fixes it. But I think one of the purposes of a good retrospective is it takes people through that process of understanding why we're trying this action to solve a certain constraint or problem or improve a situation. And the great thing about retrospectives is, you know, hopefully you're doing them regularly. And so, a time box means that you can review, do you want to do more of this and amplify it or make it more sort of official? Or do you want to sort of revert it and say, actually, that was a, you know, not successful experiment. Let's go back to how it was working. So, you know, I think the idea of particularly the when it involving people is the sort of reversibility side, right, of like, you know, we're not just going to go pair programming full time. We're going to experiment for a week or two and let's sort of see what we learn from that. And I think that's part of the key is like expecting that we're going to make mistakes and then, you know, amplify the things that are good or not. So I think involving people is part of it. As part of the experiment is useful. I think the time boxing side of it and sort of saying, let's try a little bit rather than sort of a big bang approach that's not reversible. Is another sort of side of it. I find that's a very effective way of actually sort of experimenting with sort of process and new practices.
Very interesting. Thanks for this advice. And now in my head pops up another one that is based on context. Mm. So let's say that I do an experiment and the experiment fails. But later on, or the team changes because we have turnover in an industry, people go to different teams, or my context change. Rather than just operate in Netherlands, I operate now in France.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see managers keeping a pool of these experiments, and do you see people experiment later, or we just throw away these experiments and reinventing the wheel every time?
So I don't see people, and I mean, I'm one of those people, I'll admit it, I don't write down every single thing that I try. I think it's kind of exhausting probably writing all of the details down, very defined. I think that's probably not as rigorous as it could be. At the same time, you know, I think I do see people trying to sort of reinvent things again and again, and sometimes it makes sense to try that again, right? So I think innovation is one of those interesting things that people talk about where, you know, the right idea at the wrong time isn't useful. Docker, say 10 years ago, wouldn't have been very useful because it was solving a problem a lot of people didn't have. But now, you know, we have so many different types of applications and different types of deployment sort of things. We needed to simplify that. That's why things like Docker make a lot more sense today, for example. I think it's definitely worth trying these things again, because sometimes it's just about like the right timing. and I think that's okay. It's a cost of exploration of dealing with a complex system is how I see it.
Yeah, indeed. I also agree. And I also see that companies don't, at least in my perspective, don't have the right tools to use from the three horizons from McKinsey and just focus on one. And perhaps this is where we can improve. And that goes a little bit back on this interview. You talk about that you saw within teams roles that are attached to positions and teams that are more fluid. Do you think that this organizational model is also enables or constrains the way that we do experiments?
Absolutely. Every organization is different based on the names, the roles, and expectations. There's sort of a, you know, you can take the whole holocratic approach, for instance. That's, I think, one extreme of really devolved kind of formal lines of responsibility, but they make very explicit sort of rules and roles, which mean that everyone can take part in many different activities. You know, I think it's a level of, for instance, clarity, or like you need to know quite a lot about it to make it successful, which is why I think a lot of people don't do that. At the same time, you know, I think people have to be comfortable with that. And something like working in a holocratic organization, for example, is going to be really radical for a lot of people. And, you know, part of the challenge of practices is as you, you know, move from one organization to another, people bring with them their sort of old habits and expectations. And anything that's too extreme can be, you know, so radical. And a good example of this is, you know, when I think about how extreme programming, you know, worked, I was working on this like 15, 20 years ago, is like, that was so radical for so many organizations. They just, you know, thought it was a hacker thing because it was like, what do you mean you don't have requirements specifications and you plan every 2 weeks, you write automated tests? Like all of this stuff was, you know, back then considered crazy. But, you know, now it's like just good practices of how we kind of work because people have realized actually these are helpful and we do more of these, you know, in other organizations and we have more of that in the community. So, you know, I think it's very helpful as a formal leader to sort of create space for other people to allow them to grow. So how you can do that is once again, dependent on that organization, the values. So yeah, an organization sort of what I think of as their operating system definitely constrains people's flexibility around this.
Very interesting. And you touch one of the topics that I'm being researched lately, holocracy or teal organizations.
Yeah.
Do you see this as a good idea but a bad timing, or this will be the future within IT, for instance?
I think it's a great idea, probably bad timing again. So, you know, I think I don't know if it's going to be adopted fully just because I think there's too much skepticism around a lot of the practices, but it doesn't mean that we can't learn from, you know, teal organizations and holocratic organizations. So that's why I really love it, is that, you know, the package of holocracy may not be so great, but there's some interesting ideas that we should use as experiments to see if they solve the problems that we have. At the same time, you know, we have other organizations, you know, you can think about Amazon or Spotify with, you know, strong autonomy, a lot of sort of fluidity without having to go sort of fully holocratic. So we also see alternative models of how teams and organizations can innovate, you know, naturally trade-offs in every large organization. Pockets will be very different as well. So context matters again. I'm not so sure. My prediction is it's not necessarily going to be adopted industry-wide, but I think we'll see similar practices that are useful come in.
Yeah, interesting. I have the same bet. Not sure if holocracy as a model will survive, but in the big picture of teal, maybe something will be there. We are going to the end and to wrap up this, just time just flies. Yeah. What are the recommendations of resources that you have for the audience of the podcast related to what we discussed today?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite books is Thinking in Systems by Daniela Meadows. You know, I think every software engineer should understand systems thinking and every leader has to. It's actually one of the reasons I've built a course on the Tech Lead Academy around this, is that, you know, we're dealing with such a ever-changing world of complexity. And as we keep coming back to this idea of context matters, and, you know, people closest to the problem are best to sort of suit that because they have the best view of that sort of system. I think that's very powerful. And so systems thinking for me is sort of a really key sort of topic that I would definitely recommend that, you know, we've been touching upon quite a lot.
Cool, thanks. I will make sure that the resources are on description of this episode so that people can follow up. Also, your Twitter handler is there, so people can reach out with questions or challenge.
Please do.
And I think that is it for today. I want to thank you big time for your time with us. So thanks.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Very interesting discussion. Thank you.
Thanks. You can follow us at S-Crafts Podcast on Twitter. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. See you next week.